I'm John Wells, and this is Newsroom Insider. This episode, Postmortem Continued. I checked my email just after 11 o'clock one night recently and saw there was a message with a subject line that said, Mohan Ramkissoon. I thought, this is why you don't check your email right before bed. Who could be writing me about him? Ramkissoon was the villain, the killer, in a true-to-life CSI-style murder case I wrote about in The Spectator 10 years ago, a 25-part series published as a book titled Postmortem. His name instantly brought back details of the case, his wife's remains found in a field in Flamborough near African Lion Safari in the spring of 2001. The body decomposed, mummified, was the phrase used by forensic pathologist David King that always stuck with me. The victim's name was Yvette Budrum. She was married to Ramkissoon, and they were raising young children in Mississauga. Both had emigrated from Guyana years before. The discovery of a body in Flamborough made it a Hamilton police homicide case. It was the unusual circumstance where identifying the victim was a challenge in itself before detectives could find the killer. That's why they brought in a forensic anthropologist from McMaster University, Shelley Saunders, to examine the bones of the skeleton, and also a forensic entomologist named Dale Morris, an insect expert, nicknamed the Bug Lady by detectives, to determine when the victim had died. The critical step had been getting a fingerprint from the dried and hardened fingertips. To do that, Hamilton forensic detectives used a technique sometimes employed to identify victims from a fire, rehydrating a fingertip with a solution to plump up the ridges in order to roll a print. The twist on that discovery of the fingerprint was how Mohan Ramkissoon had inadvertently given police the critical clue to catching him. That is, the fingerprint developed from Budrum's remains would have been of no use to detectives if not for the fact that her prints were on a police database, and the prints were on that database because she'd been charged with assault by her husband, Ramkissoon. In September 2000, the couple had a fight. Ramkissoon told police she had threatened him with a knife. Police arrested her. A month later, he murdered Yvette, bludgeoning her with a hammer, then strangling her to make sure she was dead. So after her fingerprint was matched, it didn't take long for police to come calling on Mohan Ramkissoon. He denied everything and then tried to flee the country, but was arrested at Pearson Airport, starting in motion the train of events that led to his conviction for second-degree murder in 2004. It was shortly after that when I started researching a series on the case. I visited the country field just on the other side of a ditch where he had left the body to rot. He had driven the body out there in the trunk of his car from Mississauga. Their family had once been to African Lion Safari years before. It perhaps occurred to him as a remote enough place to do the deed. I stood in that field for quite a while, listening, thinking. I kept thinking about how this woman had been here, certainly not resting in peace, all through a fall season, then winter, and into the spring. I wrote this scene at the start of the book. If the dark eyes could see, if the face could turn up to the sky, the view would offer a peek through tall grass, weeds, leaves of an old basswood tree, and the morning's first light filtered through rain clouds. It is quiet beside the rolling cornfield, the only sound that of wind brushing leaves, the buzz of insects. A rumble of thunder. Rain ticks the cornfield, the trees. Drops perhaps find their way to that very spot, through the brush, and dot the cold skin of the neck where the crescent moon pendant rests. It had been a bad astrological period, a Saturn phase. The iron pendant would bring luck. Summer had never really arrived that year. It was the kind of summer in which the sky seems a perpetual dead gray. Rain is never far away, and the cool air always seems to betray an end rather than a beginning. In the early evening, clouds break. The sun shoots rays of light between the tree branches. The clarity lasts just an hour. Then darkness bleeds into the blue sky. That was at the start of the post-mortem book. I looked up some weather details from a past date and wrote that up. Just the sense of loneliness of this woman's body lying there, and no one looking for her. Ram Kassoon had said that she had left him. No one was even looking for her, and he believed he had gotten away with it. I met Mohan Ram Kassoon in person for my research. I interviewed him at Millhaven Prison in Kingston in 2005. I had written him a letter first. He replied, saying he wanted to tell me the real story. Meeting him in that prison, I was struck by two things. One, how small he was about 5'3". His wife had been a larger person than him, but he had carried her bloody body out of their home and ultimately tossed her into that field. And two, he cried frequently during the interview, professing his innocence. He kept telling me police got the wrong guy, that the killer had been another man, that his wife had been having an affair with. And indeed, his lawyer had suggested at trial that this other man was the alternative suspect. It was difficult to listen to, Ram Kassoon. It is a powerful thing, a man in tears saying he was wrongly convicted of murdering his wife, who he kept telling me he had loved. Our criminal justice system is weighted to try and prevent the innocent from doing time. What if he was innocent, I wondered. What if police got it wrong? But later I realized Ram Kassoon had been lying about several things in the interview, and I came to be certain that he was guilty and had been trying to manipulate me. Why wouldn't he, after all? What else did he have to lose? And so, back to that email I received recently at 11:30 at night, the one with Ram Kassoon's name in the subject line. Ram Kassoon had lost his appeal of his murder conviction in 2006. It was case closed, but clearly not for everyone. Not by a long shot. I opened the email. It was from a woman who lives in New York City in the Bronx. Her name is Radhika Rudolph. "Hello, Mr. Wells," it read, and continued, quote, "There are some rumors that Mohan was released and is in the United States at this moment. However, I have no idea how to go about finding out if he was released on parole. If by chance you have any information that can help me, I would really appreciate it." Ram Kassoon was eligible to apply for parole last year. I replied back to her and said I would find out from the Parole Board of Canada if Mohan Ram Kassoon was a free man. Radhika Rudolph's mother, whose name was Rampati Chattergoon, was murdered in the Bronx in 1987, beaten and stabbed multiple times. Ram Kassoon had been dating one of Chattergoon's daughters, Radhika's sister. Ram Kassoon, who was then in his early 20s, was a prime suspect in that homicide. Radhika had contacted me years before after reading the postmortem story online. Her mother's murder had been the dark epilogue to the story I wrote. Ram Kassoon had been brought to justice for the Yvette Budrum homicide, but this other murder from long ago was left hanging out there. In 2006, two NYPD detectives showed up unannounced to see Mohan Ram Kassoon in Millhaven Pen. It surely would have caught him off guard, two American cops dropping in on him like that. They came to see him a second time as well. One of the NYPD detectives told me in an interview that Ram Kassoon lied through his teeth the entire time, but that in the end he admitted he had committed the murder in the Bronx of Rampati Chattergoon. He refused to sign a confession, however. No charges were laid by the Bronx District Attorney's Office. To my knowledge, and I've tried to find out more this week, and I'm still waiting to hear back from the NYPD, the Bronx investigation has gone no further. The last I was told by the NYPD detective, they were waiting on DNA analysis to be developed, hopefully from evidence gathered at the scene. But bear in mind that evidence was gathered in 1987, before DNA was an investigative tool, so it all may well turn up nothing. I've lost touch with one of the two NYPD detectives, who is likely retired by now. The other, I've learned, recently died. Rampati Chattergoon's murder in 1987 was one of 1,672 homicides that year in New York City alone. Time moves on, but Rampati Chattergoon's family has not. Radhika Rudolph wrote this in a subsequent email to me. Quote, when I think of all the times that has passed and how Mohan managed to go on with his life, get married, start a family, and then commit a similar crime, I shudder with anger to a point of rage because my family is stuck on rewind. We relive the days as if it was yesterday. Every morning I look in the mirror and see my mother because I look exactly like her. And I'm now the 45, she was 46 when he killed her. My dad has never remarried or had any relationships. He has her photographs all over his room and house. He's now 80. My brother and five sisters cry on a daily basis and are reminded that Mohan is not held accountable for what he did. I cry daily now, more now than I did growing up with her. I was only 15 years old at the time. The parole board needs to hear our story. He cannot be let free, unquote. I heard back from the Parole Board of Canada earlier this week. The documents they sent suggest that Ram Kassoon was on the fast track to being released on full parole. The only catch would be that he would be deported back to his native Guyana. The board noted that while in prison, he had behaved well, had cascaded to minimum security. He had been charged with five offenses in prison, but only convicted on one, for hoarding pain meds for kidney stones he suffered from. And he had admitted to killing Yvette Budrum. He had, quote, taken responsibility for the death of the victim, as the board put it. I thought back to Ram Kassoon's teary assertion of innocence when I sat across the table from him. It was in his interest to lie back then. It's in his interest to tell the truth now, I suppose. Parole was looking very good for him, but then he provided his case management team with a letter from a police force, dated December 14, 2015, that said police officers would make sure he checked in with him once a month when he was released. The name of the police force is blacked out in the parole board decision documents, but it must be a Guyanese police force. The only problem, the board wrote, is that the letter turned out to be fraudulent. Phone numbers provided in the letter were fictitious. Ram Kassoon, of course, denied falsifying the letter, claiming that his brother had provided it. The brother told a board official that a friend gave it to him. Quote, in light of the issues surrounding the fictitious letter, the board ruled, the Correctional Service of Canada now has serious concerns, unquote. So Ram Kassoon's parole was denied. This was last year, and then just in January this year, his appeal of that denial was rejected as well. He remains in prison and will be eligible to reapply for full parole next year, at which time the board has 6 months to schedule a review. In emails, Radhika Rudolph was pleased to hear the news that the man who killed Yvette Budrum in cold blood and who allegedly murdered her mother is doing more time. But she was disheartened to see in the documents I shared with her that there was no mention of the Bronx homicide in the Parole Board of Canada review. Was her mother's murder, for which NYPD detectives investigated Ram Kassoon, that he told him he committed, not deserving of at least being part of the body of information the board considers? I asked a parole board official if the Bronx homicide is on Ram Kassoon's resume. I was told for privacy issues they can't tell me that. So then I asked, in general terms, if an offender has more information on their case that the board is aware of, might that simply not make it into documents like the ones they shared with me about his parole board hearing? The official told me that was true. There's always more information, police reports, psychological reports, and so on, that form part of an offender's file, and that the board members view all of it. I emailed Radhika and told her that. I wrote her that I believe the parole board official is perhaps trying to telegraph to me that her mother's murder is part of Mohan's file, even though she is not allowed to tell me that. But then again, maybe I'm just looking for silver linings. Radhika wrote back to me, Dear John, I hope you are right. Silver linings is what I was reaching for in my concluding words to the postmortem book. I suppose in many of my crime stories, I look for subtle signs of redemption. And in this case, it's difficult to find them. But I closed by writing about the funeral for Yvette Budrum that took place nearly 4 years after she had been murdered. I interviewed Yvette's daughter, Lisa, who told me about the funeral. The morning had been foggy, the air warm and moist at the cemetery in Mississauga. I quoted from the funeral service as I finished the story with these few lines. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. As the funeral concluded in the heavy air, Lisa felt cool drops kiss her skin. Maybe it was a sign, a symbol, she thought, after all the ugliness of cleansing. She was looking for small blessings and found one in the gentle rain escorting her mother on a final passage from this world. Thanks for listening. I'm John Wells.